Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about a very interesting new history book entitled Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of Racism in America. The term sundown towns is basically, the idea is a lot of towns around the country, and especially here in the Midwest, excluded minorities after dark. And the term comes from our guest, James Lowen. He's a historian and sociologist and author of the book we'll be discussing during this hour. And what's been really fascinating to me is, as I have read the book, I often go out for lunch or whatever, and I read, you know, to do my homework for the show. And I would run into people, and they say, what are you reading? And I show them the book. And instantly, people would have stories about various towns where they grew up around here in the Midwest. And they say, oh, yes, there was a sign on the bridge that said, if you're, you know, probably not the kind of word I want to use, but if you're basically a minority, don't be in town when the sun goes down. And that's the origin of the term sundown towns. And we'll talk about that during this hour. James Lowen, by the way, grew up in Decatur, Illinois, and has had a distinguished career as a sociologist and historian. He's professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont, where for 20 years he taught courses in race relations. He's also the author of the best-selling book Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and his other books include Lies Across America and Mississippi, Conflict and Change. He's also a distinguished lecturer of the Organization of American Historians and a member of the American Historical Association and the American Sociological Association. His latest book, Sundown Towns, was published this month by the New Press, and we'll talk about what's in the book during this hour of the show. We invite you into the conversation. If you have questions, comments, stories of your own, you can join us. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, if you're listening online anywhere in the U.S., in fact, 800-222-9455, and we welcome you to join our conversation. Jim Lowen, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
How did you get on the trail of the subject of the book, Sundown Towns?
Well, it's a good question, because growing up in Decatur, I vaguely knew that all these little towns around Decatur, like Nyanic and Pena and Maloa and Monticello, were all white, but it never occurred to me that that was on purpose. I kind of figured, well, you know, I kind of like living in Decatur. There's more movies and stuff to see, so why wouldn't black folks feel the same way, you know? So it just never occurred to me. I went to college in Northfield, Minnesota. I went to Carleton College, and there I learned of one sundown town, and that was Edina, Minnesota, which was and is the most prestigious and the wealthiest suburb of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And in the early 60s, when I was in college, people from Edina told me, some with pride, that Edina had not one Negro and not one Jew. Just for the record, today it has one of each, but back then it didn't. And I just kind of thought, I filed that away in my mind, but I thought, that's outrageous, mm-hmm. you know? And then I learned about a similar wealthy suburb outside of New York City. That's Darien, Connecticut. Darien was actually quite famous briefly for keeping out Jews. There was a book written about it, a novel called Gentleman's Agreement, which was then made into the Academy Award-winning movie for 1948, Gentleman's Agreement, starring Gregory Peck. And of course it had no blacks. The only African-Americans allowed to spend the night were live-in servants. Again, I was outraged. Then it was actually here in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois when a student told me several years ago, because I've often been a scholar in residence here for a week or so, and a student told me that he grew up near Anna, Illinois, and that everybody in Anna and everybody in nearby towns knew that Anna meant A-N-N-A, ain't no niggers allowed. And in fact, that is true. Now, of course, Anna was named for somebody named Anna in 1854. But I came to learn that in 1909, Anna drove out its black population and has been a sundown town ever since. Now, when I say ever since, I have to qualify that. I don't know if an African-American household, couple, whatever, can live in Anna safely and happily today. I do know that people like the newspaper editor, the research librarian, and others told me that they didn't think that any such household existed as of 2002 and 2003, which is when I did research in Anna. And of course, this is 2005. Maybe it's all changed. Mm-hmm. But I call them sundown towns rather than continuing sundown towns or former sundown towns, because I can't really know what happened last year or last month.
So how widespread are these sundown towns?
Well, that's the key question. When I started to do this research, I figured I was going to do a little more research in Illinois than any other place, because if somebody told me, oh, you know, Villa Grove was a sundown town, well, growing up in Decatur, I kind of knew where Villa Grove was, you know. But I have done research in Oregon, in Florida, all over the U.S. I expected to find 10 sundown towns in Illinois and maybe 50 across the country. Instead, I believe I have actually found approximately 472 sundown towns in Illinois alone, which would mean something like 10,000 nationally. And I would point out that Illinois has a total of about 670 towns larger than 1,000 people. That means a majority, in fact, over 65% of all incorporated towns in Illinois had sundown policies. And I think the same was true in Indiana, in Oregon, and in several other states outside the traditional South. And that's an interesting part of the story. Excuse me. Sometimes people would, usually people say to me when I tell them what I'm researching, oh, yeah, down in Mississippi, in Alabama. And I say, no, not at all. Mm-hmm. And I did, in fact, an exhausting study of Mississippi, and I located 6 probable sundown towns, 3 of which I know are not sundown towns anymore, mm-hmm. compared to 472 in Illinois. The traditional South just never did this. Why would you make your maid leave? Why would you make your cotton pickers leave?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, talk about the policies that result in, you know, what you've termed sundown towns. I mean, was it an official policy? Was it,
That's a good question.
Yeah, you know, how did it work?
Well, it varies. Many, many towns have a tradition of having passed an ordinance. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example from Arcola, which is about 20, 30 miles south of here.
Yeah.
I went to Arcola, and I'd already heard from many former or present residents that it was a sundown town. So I dropped in at the town hall. They all told me it had an ordinance. Mm-hmm. So I talked to the clerk. Now, this wasn't the town clerk. This is the clerk in the town hall. Usually town clerks are at home gardening or something. But anyway, and I said to her, hi, my name's Jim Lowe, and I grew up in Decatur. Of course, anywhere doing research in Illinois, I would mention that. And right. I'm doing a study of all-white towns that for a long time were all-white on purpose. And I've heard that Arcola is one of these. Usually I would ask, but in this case I'd already had it confirmed so many times that I didn't really ask. And she nodded, and I said, now, does Arcola have any kind of ordinance about this? And she replied, you mean like our sundown ordinance? That's what I've heard it called.
Uh-huh.
And I said, yes. And she said, oh, yes. And I said, well, can you share it with me? And she said, well, sure, but it's 4:20, and that's the time it was, 4:20 p.m., and it might take us a little while to find it. Could you come back tomorrow morning? So I said, fine. I came back tomorrow morning. We went through records and stuff. We looked for 2 hours, mm-hmm. and we couldn't find it. Now, does it exist? I think it does. And I think what happened was some city council meeting in, you know, February 8th, 1912 or something passed it. But it never got into the codified book of ordinances. In fact, some small towns don't even have a codified book of ordinances. But everybody knows they passed it. And since everybody knows they passed it, they abide by it.
Yeah.
And if a black family moved in such a town, they would be told to leave by the chief of police in many cases. And in many, many towns, I've heard stories of that's exactly what happened. Now, other towns, even people told me that we never passed an ordinance. We never needed to. That is, they just did it informally.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one way of doing it informally is through bad behavior. I want to give you an example of bad behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, please.
I don't mean to pick on Arcola, yeah. But I do have this very eloquent story of bad behavior given to me by a former Arcola resident. Actually, she's approved my use of her name, Diana McCarty. She was in seventh grade in Arcola in 1978. And, you know, everybody knows everything in a small town. So she heard through the grapevine that a new family was moving in with 2 little kids. And she's all excited because she's a babysitter mm-hmm. in seventh grade. So here's what she writes. Later in the week, I was in the school office. This is probably the grade 1 through 8 school office, when I saw a black woman at the secretary's desk. She looked angry. I overheard that her children could not get registered for school until all their records got transferred. I also overheard lots of conversation regarding not knowing what happened to the records and blaming the mail service, etc. It didn't dawn on me what was happening until a few days later, after school at my grandfather's shop, which was located across the side alley from the Byright grocery store. That's the main supermarket in town. Now, at this point reading this, it hadn't really dawned on me what had happened. I hope my readers, my listeners, are a little smarter than I am. Then she goes on to write, "The same woman I had seen in the office at school pulled up to the Byright and got out of her car with her two kids. She went to the front door, and there was a closed sign on it, and the doors were locked. She looked around, as I did, because the parking lot was full. People inside looked to be shopping. I met her gaze, and in a brief instant, I had an epiphany. The light bulb was so bright, I thought I was blinded. I was so angry. I took her across the alley, and she met my grandpa. They talked in hushed tones while I played with the kids. I overheard them talking about where she could get some things. He offered her gas. He had his own above-ground tank. The grandfather ran the only auto body shop in town. And see, this is an issue, too. Where is she going to buy gas if nobody sells her gas, right, which is the case in many sundown towns? And he gave her the names and locations of some Amish friends of his that could supply her with milk, eggs, meat, etc. They were there one day, and a couple of weeks later, they were gone. I don't blame them for leaving in the middle of the night. Business slowed at my grandfather's shop for a while. You see, simply for the reason that he had befriended them. But it picked back up with time. He was the only auto body shop in town." Now, that's the kind of story I get from a story in Arkansas, from the town of Ozark, Arkansas, which is in the non-southern part of Arkansas, if you will. Again, the southern part of Arkansas wouldn't do it. But in northwest Arkansas, it's more Midwestern and Ozark. And, of course, the town of Ozark is in the Ozarks. And a student that I met, a college student, said that when she was in seventh grade, which would be just 1995 or so, a black family moved to town. Their two kids get on the school bus to go to school. They get beaten up before they ever get to school, and the family moves.
We'll talk about more stories and what's the history of some of this stuff. Let me just reintroduce our guest, and we have a couple callers we'll get right to. We're talking this morning with James Loewen. He's the author of Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of Racism in America, the book just published by the New Press, and it details the history and sort of the mechanisms of this phenomenon he calls Sundown Towns, those towns which officially exclude African Americans and other minorities, and he found a surprising number, to say the least, of these in his research. We have a couple callers and time for others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some listeners.
Okay.
First up is someone on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. First, I want to congratulate him on his books. They are excellent. And I just wanted to mention that a couple years ago I emailed him with some information, and I just wanted to know whether he had confirmed it. Let me mention to you briefly what the information was and then let him talk. I have understood over the years that in passenger trains going from Chicago south to toward Memphis, that the point at which they had to segregate had to start segregating was Mattoon. And I just wonder if he had confirmed that. Let me mention one other thing in defense of Mattoon. I would assume, at least, that this suggests that there wasn't a huge problem with integration in Mattoon.
That's right.
But there would be a very big problem when you go south of Mattoon. I thought I would say that in defense of Mattoon.
Sure.
But I just wonder if he had confirmed that or whether he wasn't able to confirm it enough to use that.
I don't put it in my book. I heard it from you, and I may have heard it from one other person.
Yeah.
What it's really a story about, though, is Effingham. Effingham is the next stop south, I believe.
Right.
And Effingham was a notorious sundown town until just recently. In fact, Effingham was so amazing that African Americans were often not allowed on the streets of Effingham, even during the day, except in certain locations. And it was an issue getting from the bus station, for instance, to the train station. And, of course, Effingham is on a major intersection of interstates. And before the interstates, it was on Route 40, the National Road, and on a main north-south road. It's also on a major intersection of railroads. Of course, it's got the city of New Orleans that you were talking about, and there used to be several trains a day going north-south on the Illinois Central.
Yeah.
And the New York Central's main route from the east to St. Louis also goes through Effingham, calls itself the Crossroads of America or something like that. And I had just all kinds of rather horrifying stories about how African Americans were harassed and were told to stay in the train station or in the bus station, or were sometimes allowed on the streets between the two, but not elsewhere in Effingham. So, although I haven't confirmed that that's when segregated seating started on the Illinois Central going south, it's plausible.
It makes sense. Okay, congratulations on your work then.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
We'll go on to next to a listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I'm calling about three towns, Monticello, Bemant, and Atwood. Are they sundown towns?
I would like to ask you what you know about them. Let me say this. There are so many suspects, both in Illinois and across the country, 10,000 in all, that I haven't been able to confirm them all. I have confirmed Monticello. Without a doubt. In fact, I've heard both, incidentally, the black community in Champaign-Urbana, many members of it, are quite aware of Monticello, and many folks are a little leery being there at night, even now. Bement and Atwood are both on my suspect list, but I don't know that I've confirmed them. At this point, my computer's smarter than I am. Could I ask, have you ever heard that about either of those towns?
Well, I have, I'm African-American.
Okay.
I have white friends, colleagues that live in those towns or grew up in those towns, and I'm fascinated by your book because one, I suspected those towns were, we call them euphemistically, white flight suburb towns.
Yes.
Which you don't say sundown towns, but I always wondered about my friends who live there or moved there recently as to what it said about them in terms of their racial attitude.
Well, let me speak to that just for a minute. I was somewhat amazed by all that, too. I mean, it's one thing to have white flight from, say, Detroit, which as a result of white flight is now 74% black.
Right.
And a lot of white folks leaving Detroit could convince themselves that their neighborhood, at least, was going to go all black, and they didn't want to be the only white in all black neighborhood. I am white, and I can empathize with that. I actually live in a majority black neighborhood in D.C., but, I'm not asking everybody to be a racial pioneer. But then I've discovered all this white flight from Champaign-Urbana, from Decatur, and even more amazingly, from Joplin, Missouri. Now, Decatur and Champaign and Urbana are about 17, 18, 19% black. There's no possibility in the foreseeable future that any of those three towns are going to go all black, not even very many neighborhoods are. And so white flight from them, I think, does say something about fear or dislike or worry about African-Americans. The most amazing case, though, is I've learned of white flight from Joplin, Missouri, to the town of Webb City. Why is that so amazing? Because Joplin, Missouri is 2% black. And so some of the white flight destinations that I've learned of around here are Mahomet, Farmer City, St. Joe, Monticello. I hadn't really done any work on Bemet and Atwood. Pena is a destination from Decatur and several other towns around Decatur, Maroa, Forsyth, and so on. And it just amazes me, then, that there is white flight from such white cities.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Sure.
Thank you so much for the call. We have a couple calls, and I'll get right to them, but I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about some of the history of how this happened. As you write about in the book, the period of time in our history following the Civil War, there was increased integration, increased civil, political, economic rights for all Americans, especially for former slaves, and a great sort of spreading of the populations of all Americans throughout the nation. And then we get to a period which you write about began in about 1890. You call it the Nader
Yes.
What happened?
That amazed me, too. We have this period called the nadir of race relations. I would date it 1890 for sure. That's exactly when it starts. And it ends around 1940. And during this period of time, race relations actually got worse in America. Now, this shakes people up because we tend to think of everything in America getting better. Transportation got better. Medicine got better. And we used to think of race relations getting better. After all, we used to have slavery. Now we don't. You know, we used to not let blacks in the major leagues. Then Jackie Robinson came along. Now we do. But it's not that simple. And in fact, the major leagues provide a good example. African Americans were in the major leagues until the nadir. They played in the 1870s and 80s. The last one played in 1889 for the then Baltimore Orioles, not actually the same team as the current ones. And then they got thrown out as the nadir set forth. Another interesting thing, I thought in my naivete that black folks just naturally went from the South to Chicago. I knew they ended up in the South Side of Chicago, and they ended up in Decatur, and they ended up in the larger cities. But that wasn't naturally. That is to say, if you look at the statistics of 1890, it turns out black folks in Illinois are more rural than white folks are. The percentage of whites in Chicago was 27%. The percentage of blacks in Chicago was something like 24%. But then, between 1890 and 1940, what happens, I call the Great Retreat. And blacks get driven out of or forced out of Mahomet, which had a black population, Edina, Minnesota, the suburb of Minneapolis, which was founded among some of the founders were black, but they get forced out of Edina. They get driven out of Pinckneyville. They get driven out of town after town in Illinois, or they pass ordinances, or think they did, not to let them in. So this is a creation of the period 1890 to 1940. Now, I have a whole analysis as to why that happened. And just to make it very short, I would say that in 1890, the Republicans, who were the good guys on race relations, the interracial party in the 19th century,
yeah,
the Party of Lincoln, whereas the Democrats called themselves the white man's party at that time. Mm. Well, the Republicans gave up on race relations in 1890 and 91. And I can actually exactly pretty much say when and why that happened. And when they gave up on it, of course, the Democrats were nothing but racist back then. So then there was nobody enforcing the Constitution. The 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution went by the boards, and blacks were deprived of citizenship in the South, beginning in 1890 with the Mississippi Constitution that was passed then. And that's one of the reasons we date the nadir from 1890. But what people don't realize is the nadir also happened in the North. The Ku Klux Klan becomes the biggest thing in many towns. So we see that, for instance, in towns like Villa Grove, even Champaign-Urbana, Klan has huge meetings of 6,000 people in little towns south of here or east or west of here. The biggest meetings ever held in many of these towns in the history, the 150-year history of the town, were Klan meetings in the 1920s. Well, this is when sundown towns originated.
I promise I'll get to the callers because we have three waiting, and I don't want to make them wait too long, but I think this is an important thing for us to cover a little bit more. Essentially, what happened was political, that the leaders, especially of the Democratic Party, because the Republicans were so strong and you know, also because the memories of the Civil War were fading for a lot of people around at this time, but the Democratic Party essentially played the race card in order to gain political power.
Yes.
And as a result of the gain of the – and if I'm you know, oversimplifying, please correct me. As a result of the gains of the Democratic Party, the Republicans played along as well.
Yes. A terrible thing happened right in 1890. The fate of the country with regard to progress in race relations was decided by a single vote. The Republicans, in kind of their last gasp of citizenship for all and of justice for all, tried to pass a fair elections bill, and it passed the House, and it failed in the Senate by one vote. And, of course, President Benjamin Harrison, a Republican, would have signed it into law. It was kind of like the 1965 Voting Rights Act. It wasn't as good as that, but it was the step in that direction, but in 1890. Well, that wasn't anything new. The Democrats had defeated numerous civil rights bills before. Some had passed, but they had defeated many. What was new, the Democrats then proceeded to denounce the Republicans as nothing but nigger lovers, as they would put it, and they literally called them black Republicans. They even invented the word miscegenation. This is a Democratic Party word saying this is what the Republicans are trying to accomplish. And, of course, this wasn't a popular program all the way back to Abraham Lincoln. He pointed out, well, you know, my sister doesn't really have to marry a black person just if we end slavery, you know. But that was the Democrats' charge. If we end slavery, we'll have miscegenation. If we have civil rights, we'll have miscegenation. So in 1891, the Republicans made a new response. They said, no, we aren't. And you remember the charge was, you ain't nothing but a bunch of nigger lovers. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a new reply. No, we aren't. And that's what I mean. That's when they gave up.
Well, there's more to that, but we have several callers, and I promised I would get to them. We'll go next to a listener on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello?
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to speak to the issue of Monticello.
Yes.
One is from personal experience. I'm a Hispanic, dark complexion, and I've been in the area about 18 years, and I can't remember exactly when I experienced this, but I was in Monticello, went into a restaurant with a white woman. And, man, the stares, the dirty looks, the looks of disgust and contempt, and that was a personal experience that I had. Then more recently, this is within, I think, 5 years, within the past 5 years, a black family moved in. One night while they were gone, a group of drunk teenagers, several of them from prominent Monticello families, totally vandalized the house. Racial slurs, get out on the walls. This was not prosecuted as a hate crime. It was, you know, considered, well, boys will be boys. You know, they're just having fun. They got a slap on the wrist, and the family moved away. Finally, another piece of information that I have not been able to confirm is that Monticello still has a city ordinance on the books prohibiting colored people in town after dark. That's what I wanted to share about Monticello. And,
sure.
One thing I wanted to ask was about the big riots in Beverly and Oaklawn, Illinois. This wasn't that long ago. I know that the folks of Beverly, Oaklawn had decided that no more blacks east of certain tracks. And there was a huge riot, race riot, in one of the parks there. And I don't know if your guest can comment on that. Thanks.
Well, thanks for the information on Monticello. It confirms other stories that I've heard, but I hadn't heard that story, for instance, about the house. Again, Monticello is one of these many towns like Arcola that has a strong oral tradition of having the ordinance. And in fact, I got that confirmed by an attorney from Monticello. So I think it does, but I haven't found it. I haven't even looked in Monticello because, I've heard oral tradition of maybe 150 ordinances, and I've only been able to look in about 10. You know, there's just too much to do. I didn't know about this riot in Beverly/Oaklawn. And let me say this. Any listener who has information that they'd like to share with me, I'd like to give my email address.
Absolutely.
And here it comes. It is J. Lowen, and that's spelled J-L-O-E-W-E-N. That's my name, Jim Lowen, J. Lowen, zoo, like the animal, Z-O-O, dot U-V-M, because I used to be at the University of Vermont, dot E-D-U. Again, that's J. Lowen at zoo dot U-V-M dot E-D-U. And I'd love to hear from you whether you have a disagreement with something I said or some information about a town I didn't even know about or whatever you have to tell me. And I want to say one other thing. I really want folks... I'm not trying to sell books on the air, but I want folks to go down to their local library in Atwood, in Beaumont, in Monticello, in every town in Illinois, and get them to buy a copy of Sundowntown. Then you can read it for free, of course. But more than that, then there is an account in that very town, which may even be a Sundowntown, of this story. Because in the history of the United States, even though there's probably been 10,000 Sundowntowns, this is the first book ever written on the subject.
I wanted to ask you about that. Why has no one noticed or written about this?
Isn't that amazing? I mean, there have been maybe 10,000 lynchings in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. The big lynching database has actually 4,500, but it misses as many as it gets. So I'm saying 10,000 is a rough guess. And there's at least 500 books that have come out on lynching, probably more like 1,000. There's more than 500 if you combine the databases right now from Amazon and the Library of Congress online. So that's something like one book for every 10 lynchings. Same number of sundown towns, and there's never been a book on the subject. I think that's because of actual suppression in many cases. For instance, many of these towns had signs. We've talked about the mm-hmm. signs. Mm-hmm. Pena had a sign. Anna had a sign. Pekin had a sign. Towns in Oregon, in California, and so on had signs. I have asked, I've located at least 150 to 200 towns that have a strong oral tradition of having a sign, including I know what the sign said, where it was. Can I get a photo of it? I ask at the Historical Society. I ask at the local library. The reply I get is, why on earth would we keep that? Well, it's only history. It's only one of the defining characteristics of your town. In the case of Anna, for instance, Anna drove out its black population in 1909. Anna, in 1954, published a 456-page book on Anna, called, of course, Anna, Illinois, A Century of Progress. There's a paragraph on every business in town. There's even a paragraph on the local Dairy Queen. Is there any mention of the expulsion of blacks in 1909? Is there any mention of the town's sundown policy? Is there any mention of what ANNA has come to mean? Nothing. So in terms of the written word, it's suppressed. You have to do this kind of research by oral history.
Well, there's lots more I want to ask, but we have several callers, and I want to get on and include them in our conversation. We'll go next to a listener on line number 3. Good morning.
Hello. Did you do any research in southern Wisconsin?
Yes. Where did you have in mind?
Whitewater.
Huh. When I went into Wisconsin, and I didn't go in very long because I didn't have time, but I also did research by email and phone and so on. I heard from some very good historians in Wisconsin. One in particular said, who was at the Wisconsin Historical Society, said, my colleagues and I agree that you may find a few of these towns in Illinois, but there are none in Wisconsin, we think.
Oh.
Well, that's not true.
I grew up in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Near Whitewater.
Yes.
And the oral tradition was that no black person could stay in Whitewater overnight. I had a good friend when I was in high school in the 50s who quit her job because she was told that she, as a waitress, she could not serve a black family who had come into the restaurant.
And what year was that again?
Probably before 1954.
Okay.
Now, by 1960s, things were changing rapidly. There were definitely both Mexican-Americans and Afro-Americans uh-huh. living in Whitewater. There were African-Americans going to the university. It was by then a university at Whitewater.
Yes.
And there were faculty members, I think, who were black. There were always a strong anti-segregation sentiment in Whitewater. There were some Jewish families in particular who were strongly opposed to it. I think probably even members of the NAACP.
Uh-huh. Well, that's wonderful information, and I wish you would email it to me. I'm glad you said it on the radio. I'm not saying anything about that, but I'd love to get it from you in writing. I have, well, a couple of sundown towns in Wisconsin would include larger cities, even the Whitewater. Manitowoc, for instance, had signs, and Appleton, which is a city of 50 to 75,000, depending on which year you look at the census.
That is ironic. The birthplace of the Liberal Republican Party.
Yes. Well, not quite. That's Ripon.
Well, Ripon, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Appleton is the birthplace of Joe McCarthy, which is maybe not quite so ironic.
We'd rather forget that.
Yes. Appleton was a sundown town, even though it has Lawrence University there, and students going to Lawrence University as late as the early 1970s told me they immediately were told that about Appleton. And it may, in fact, be that every town around Appleton, even including Green Bay, may have been a sundown town. I haven't nailed them. I do know that Green Bay was the last team in the NFL to hire a black player, except for the infamous George Allen, owner of the Washington Redskins. And, of course, the name there is part of the problem. He wouldn't do it until he was actually threatened by the federal government with loss of use of the stadium in D.C. But other than that, this just blew my mind. I would have thought that Green Bay, I mean, what, there's nothing to fear. Are they fearing a black influx? You know, what's going on? But Green Bay was the last team other than that to admit a black player.
I think Wisconsin was a strongly divided state. Mm-hmm. There were ultra-conservatives and bigots, and there were also ultra-liberals, the La Follette group.
Yeah, makes sense. Mm-hmm. Thanks for
your call.
Particularly
the Norwegians and
The Norwegians themselves are split?
No, they were strongly liberal.
I see. Okay.
Progressive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the call. I'm going to ask one question I think is kind of important that you raise in the book, and then I want to get on to other callers. What is the impact of this phenomenon? I mean, does segregation in housing have some deep implication for race relations, economic opportunity? I mean, talk about that.
Yeah, I think it has all kinds of impact. First of all, we might think about it in metropolitan areas. The richest suburb and the most prestigious suburb of Chicago to this day is Kenilworth. Kenilworth was founded with documents stating there was to be no blacks and no Jews. And there weren't for a while. Then a Jewish family actually rented a house and eventually, after living in it for 7 years or so on a rental basis, bought it. And so that maybe broke the Jewish barrier, although it maybe didn't. I mean, there's some issues about that. In the year 2000, not one single black household in Kenilworth. Now, the problem with that is it makes it hard for now interracial suburbs like Oak Park, which, by the way, was a sundown town, but Oak Park caved in 1947 when a remarkable black couple bought a house there. Oak Park is famously integrated. Park Forest is another former sundown town that famously integrated and is fairly stably integrated today. But it's hard to be an integrated suburb around Chicago because people tend to, especially white folks, to look up and to model on what's up. And what's up is Kenilworth. And so as you become richer yourself, you want to buy a house in Kenilworth. That's the destination. Or the Kenilworths of the world. It's not just Kenilworth. So that's one way that sundown suburbs, in this case, play a terrible role in our society. The next thing they do, I think they have a terrible impact on white folks. The rhetoric, the words, and also the attitudes that are displayed in many sundown towns to this day are just terrible. The term of choice in many sundown towns, and not just in the South, where they're rare, but in the Midwest and even in the Far West, the term of choice is the N-word. I have a wonderful account from somebody actually in Champaign who grew up in Oblong, Illinois, which was a sundown town, may still be, I don't know. The biggest city to Oblong is Terre Haute, Indiana. And she went there when she was a little kid to see the pediatrician. And she said to me, now in Terre Haute, there were two things we didn't have in Oblong. Black folks and nuns. And I was talking about them. And my mother said to me, no, dear, in this town, you must use the word Negro. Because, of course, she was using the word nigger. Mm-hmm. Meaning, it's fine to use that term in Oblong. But just don't use it in Terre Haute. Mm-hmm. And I've heard of sundown towns where it's still fine to use that term. Mm-hmm. Well, even if we're not talking about that term, I don't think it's good for you to grow up in Kenilworth. Because, of course, what your parents are saying to you is, we want to do everything right for you. We want to give you the best childhood we can. And that means keep blacks away from you.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are economic impacts from being excluded, from living in particular areas. But then, when you can't live somewhere, you have to live somewhere else.
Yes.
So how does this impact, you know, the cities, you know, like Chicago
sure.
and the economic sure. opportunities for the population?
Sure. How does it impact Katrina?
Precisely.
I mean, what you find then is that I think it's not only an economic impact, it's also a psychological impact. But it's certainly true that black folks living in the South Side of Chicago don't have very many role models of, let's say, a successful architect. They certainly don't have any role models of a successful white architect because there's no white folks living anywhere near them. And they don't have very many role models of a successful black architect because black folks are more likely to move to Oak Park. So what you end up with is not just a lack of knowledge of how to be successful that you learn from anybody around you. Mm-hmm. You also end up with a sense that, as I quote one little kid saying to a Danish interviewer, actually, we must have done something wrong, we as a group, because, look, they make it, you know, it's because we're excluded. So there is a legacy of exclusion and hopelessness there that plays a role, too.
Our lines are full. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. I'm increasingly horrified as I listen to the show. I thought some downtowns were a thing, you know, of the past. And I've been in Champaign-Urbana long enough to remember when white people boycotted the white barbers who would not cut the hair of black people.
Mm-hmm.
And that finally was solved. Mm-hmm. And then I remember when Champaign and Urbana became integrated after the word came down about integrating schools. And there was a lot of white flight from the community because they didn't want their children from Champaign-Urbana because they didn't want their children to go to school with African Americans. But I thought that the sundown towns were a thing of the past, and I am pretty horrified. And just as people boycotted the barbers who would not cut the hair of black people, perhaps those of us who live in Champaign-Urbana who visit these surrounding towns like Atwood and Bement and certainly Monticello and certainly Mahomet, perhaps we should start boycotting these towns. These towns advertise, or these businesses advertise on WILL, and should WILL not receive advertising from these towns, if indeed what you said about Monticello was this horrible case, was it Monticello or Mahomet, where young people went and destroyed a home that was owned by an African-American family. That's sort of unforgivable. And perhaps we should invite the Monticello City Council on this show and ask them what they think about such things. And I, for one, I'm going to start boycotting these towns because I don't need to spend my money there if they are treating African-Americans with such contempt and hatred.
Well, I think you have a point, and the last chapter of my book is what to do about this problem. And just as a minimum, I would suggest that Monticello should do three things. First, and not just Monticello, of course, Mahomet and Villa Grove and all the other towns that have had this policy, all 472 of them in Illinois and all 10,000 of them across the country. First, they should admit it. And this is a heck of a problem. Folks just say, we never had any policy. You know, it's just been chance. Anyway, they should admit it. Second, they should apologize and state it was a wrong policy. After all, George Wallace, before he died, apologized for segregation. Third, they should state, we are now open to all and we welcome all. And I think that's just a minimum. And if they don't do that, then I suggest some other things that people can do to make some progress on this matter.
Okay. Hope that gives the caller's question. We have several callers waiting, and we'll go next to line number four. Good morning.
Hi. I have three points that I'd like to make just briefly. The first is that in late 1958, I went to work for the Division of Unemployment Compensation, and listening in on my interview with an unemployed person was a black person. He was there to determine whether or not I knew what I was doing and how my interview went and so on. And afterwards, I asked someone who the guy was, and I was told this was a guy who was appointed the first black office manager in downstate Illinois. But in downstate Illinois, unemployment compensation office managers had some standing in the community. They usually met with the business communities, the various luncheons that they had where policies for the towns were determined and so on. And after one of those meetings, or well, the first meeting that he attended, he was approached by the mayor of the town. I wasn't told what town this was, but it was somewhere in downstate Illinois. And he was told, "We welcome you here during the day, but we don't want your kind after sundown in this town."
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went back and told his story to the head of the division, who passed the word on to Governor Stratton. Stratton said, "I'm not going to do anything about it," and that's where it stayed.
Hmm. There you go. Thanks for the story.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to cut the caller off, but we just have about maybe 6 minutes left, and a couple of people have been waiting a while. I want to try to include as many people as we possibly can before we run out of town. Time, before we run out of town, or both.
There's a Freudian slip.
Certainly are a lot of stories just by raising the subject, aren't there?
Yeah.
So we'll go on next to a listener on line number two. Good morning. Hello? Is the caller there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know if, in your research, how this affects law enforcement when law enforcement recruits from these towns, and second, how does this affect jury pools, and does this explain why our prison populations and jail populations are predominantly African-American, and is it subject to maybe overrule a case, or would you recommend not, you know, defendants, black defendants, not having people from these towns be on the jury?
That's a good question. Let me just point out two anecdotes, if I will, in reply. The most famous trial in the United States in the last several years was, of course, the O.J. trial in California, which you may remember was moved by the prosecution from Los Angeles, where the crime was committed, to Simi Valley. Simi Valley was a sundown suburb of Los Angeles and was when they had the trial at least 98% non-black, overwhelmingly white. Excuse me, that's not the O.J. trial. The O.J. trial is quite different. That took place.
Rodney King?
It's the Rodney King
right.
trial. Mm-hmm. And it relates to why there was a innocent, not the Rodney King trial, but the trial of the policeman who beat him for so very long. And that trial was in Simi Valley, and it was not considered legitimate by the black community, and I think they have a point. It was not a jury of King's peers or of Los Angeles cross-section. It was an almost all-white jury from a former sundown suburb. The other thing I was going to say, you asked about police officers. Even worse is correctional officers. The United States has a policy, it seems, and certainly Illinois has this policy, of locating prisons in sundown towns. And we do this, I think, because, for one thing, sundown town representatives stay in even Congress and certainly stay in state legislatures for a long time. And so they have some clout. And also, some of these sundown towns are backward in other ways, so they don't have much economic development, so they seek a prison for economic reasons. So we see that the correctional center is in Vandalia. The correctional center is in Dwight. These are both confirmed sundown towns. And this is true across the United States. So when black visitors, family members and so on, go to another one is in Pinckneyville, another one is near Vienna. All of these are sundown towns. It's a heck of a thing. It's like cruel and unusual punishment because it's very difficult for your family to visit. They feel quite worried about it. They want to get out of town fast. I think this is not appropriate. I think we should make a policy of not rewarding sundown towns with governmental largesse.
Very interesting. We have another caller waiting patiently on line number three. Let's include them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a enrolled Cherokee member from Oklahoma. And growing up, my grandpa used to take me across the line into Arkansas. And I heard you mention Northwest Arkansas earlier.
Yes.
And the town that we would go into was called Siloam Springs.
Yes.
And walking down the street downtown, I remember as a little kid in the 70s, there were signs on some of the windows that would say, "No niggers or Indians allowed."
Yep.
And I remember as a kid, my grandpa saying, you know, once you get old enough, hopefully that'll change. And I was wondering, do you include, you know, some of these sundown towns with the native populations that may be close to them?
Yes, I do. In Nevada, there were two towns that sounded a whistle at 6 p.m. to tell Native Americans to be out of town. Villa Grove, incidentally, near here, sounded a whistle, a siren, at 6 p.m. until 1999 to tell African Americans to be out of town. So particularly in the West, there were towns that were entirely sundown towns vis-a-vis Native Americans. There were also a bunch of them that had that policy vis-a-vis Chinese Americans.
Thank you.
Well, in fact, Illinois was a sundown state when it came to Native Americans, I believe, for some time.
Native Americans? I don't think so.
No.
It did pass a law in the 1840s, even earlier, and confirmed it in the 1840s, that blacks could not move in.
Okay.
And six states did this in all, maybe even more, but six that I know of. Illinois did not really enforce that law very well, though. The only state that really enforced it was Oregon. And Oregon ended up with a whole bunch of sundown towns as a result. But I want to get this story in, and so let me tell it right
Absolutely,
now. And if
yeah.
we have time for another caller, it's hard to do this research sometimes because people don't want to tell you stuff. And the funniest example of somebody who didn't want to tell me something in my whole research came from Villa Grove. When I first heard that Villa Grove had this whistle that sounded at 6 p.m. to tell blacks to be out of town, I thought it was apocryphal. I figured out, well, it probably had a whistle, and it probably was a sundown town, but the idea that the two were connected. So I thought it was probably a shift change at a factory or some other kind of 6 p.m. whistle, but it turned out to be true. And I verified it by doing interview after interview in Villa Grove on a Monday several years ago. And my very last interview was at the weekly newspaper. And I talked with the editor, and I want to just read you the transcript. I said, "Hello, I'm Jim Lowen. I grew up over in Decatur, and now I'm doing research on all-white towns that are all-white on purpose, including this one." And I pointed to the ground. I didn't usually say things like that. I usually tried to get them to tell me. But in this case, I had done 10 former interviews in Villa Grove. I knew I had it nailed. It was 4:30 p.m. I needed to go back to Champaign-Urbana. The editor nodded. He agreed. I said, quote, "I understand you have, or used to have until recently, a whistle on your water tower that went off every evening at 6 p.m. "Yes," he agreed. "Tell me the story about that whistle," I asked. "I don't know any story about that whistle," he replied. Now, I actually didn't believe this. I figured the editor must know the story. Seven other people had confirmed it to me. But what am I going to do, shake him and say, "You do too"? So as I said, I was done. I said, "Okay," and I started to make my farewell. At this point, as I turned to leave, his secretary from over at the desk to the side said, "You mean the story that was the signal for blacks to be out of town?" And I nodded and I said, "Yes, that story." And she said, "I never heard that story." Isn't that interesting? I never heard the story that she had just told me.
Well, that and many other stories are to be found in the book Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of Racism in America. The author is James Lowen, last name L-O-E-W-E-N. If you have stories to share, we have his email address here. You can write to me if you didn't write it down. We're going to have to stop because we're out of time. Thanks so much, Jim Lowen, for being here.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks to the callers.